Welcome once again to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm Justine Ward, your host. We are continuing our crime series for the next few weeks. This week and next week, we will stick with true crime. The series Crime Classics was a high-quality show dramatizing true crimes throughout history, from ancient Greece to the Wild West. Today we have two stories of filial discord set a century and a world apart. First, we give you a story of an English son who is impatient for his inheritance, and we learn how a gun operates in 1739. Lou Merrill plays Thomas Highland, our narrator, and I know you will enjoy the music and incidental sound effects designed by Bernard Herrmann. Here is Crime Classics, The Shrapnel Body of Charles Drew Sr., first broadcast July 6, 1953, on CBS.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Highland. I'm going to tell you another true crime story. Listen. The sound you hear is that of a man having his right-hand hook filed. It's Saturday night in London town, and he wants to be gleaming and presentable. The year is 1739, when a well-sharpened hook in London town was considered prudent. And Captain Ratt, that's R-A-T-T, besides being a drunkard, a scoundrel, and a smuggler, was a prudent man. The young man handling the file is named Charles Drew, Jr., and he is performing this intimate little ironmongery because he needs a favor done. Captain Ratt can help him out. He can supply the youngster with an alibi. And Junior badly needs one, for he has just shot his father dead. And tonight, my report to you on the shrapneled body of Charles Drew, Sr.
Crime Classics, a new series of true crime stories taken from the records and newspapers of every land, from every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Highland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now, once again, Mr. Thomas Highland.
As I've told you, is 1739, and the place? Long Melford in the county of Suffolk. Long Melford was a small, quiet town near London, and in it, a manor, and in the manor, a high-vaulted room of roaring fire, great shadows, and flying buttresses. Directly beneath the buttress that flew toward the west, two men, father, son, Charles Drew, Sr., Jr.
Son?
Yes, father?
The time has come for you and I to have a talk.
I'm grateful. There are things vexing me.
Perhaps what I have to tell you will answer your vexation.
I'm very fortunate.
I've tried to be a good father.
A most excellent father. There's no one richer than you in Long Melford.
Which is what I want to talk with you about.
I know.
I've drawn my latest will. This.
What a gentle and most excellent father I have. Have you ear to what they say of you in the square?
No, what do they say?
That you are gentle and most excellent. What of the will?
I'm leaving everything to your five sisters, and to you sixpence, to lend, to spend, to start your fortune.
But the last will, the one before this, you left me everything, and only a kind word to my five sisters.
That was when you were 11. Now you are 19.
And a good son.
To whom good?
To you good.
Nay, to the cutthroats and smugglers with whom you cousin.
It is not so.
This is so, I know it. You consort with people of ill fame, and also with Mr. Richardson's housekeeper.
Shall I explain this of Mr. Richardson's housekeeper to you?
It would be well.
She is a most excellent housekeeper, and I wish to employ her for our own household.
And this you have been trying to do for the last year?
Oh, she demands high payment.
Our family can afford high payment.
But I personally cannot, Father. Not until I inherit your fortune.
And which with this new will never be.
Father.
I don't scare, son. Wave that gun or...
A smattering of intelligence concerning 1739 ballistics. Ammunition was chiefly of two types, round or irregular. The former was manufactured by dropping chunks of molten lead from a great height, and when it reached the vat of water at the bottom of flight, it was round, due to centrifugal forces and gravity. Among men who puttered with this sort of thing, round shot was considered pretty fancy. Mostly, guns were loaded in this era by whatever iron junk was to hand. It should be recorded that Charles Drew, Jr. had stopped at a small junkyard on his way to talk with his dad. This is the reason the coroner found numerous pieces of irregular junk iron in Dad's corpse. Let's see what Dad's son is up to now. Scene, Ye Old Bunnery, a rundown bake shop on Abernathy Lane. The time, 2 hours later. Principals, Charles Drew, Jr., and a Mr. Humphrey, Bunbaker.
What brings you to Ye Old Bunnery, Charlie?
I want to know a thing.
And that is what?
Humphrey, how would you like £100?
You were saying £100?
All you must do is say you killed a man.
I killed a man. My £100, please.
You must say you killed my father.
I killed your father. My £100.
To the police.
Charlie.
£200 now, and £200 after you've been to the police.
You kill your poor old dad, Charlie?
With this pistol.
Huh? Leave you to be a very rich man?
If someone were to go to the police and said he killed my father, he would be rich too.
With his neck in the gibbet.
I would guarantee that the man would be released. Inside of a week, he would be released. There are jailers who would release such a man, persuaded correctly, with enough money.
A guarantee, I know a guarantee. Write me a confession that you killed your poor dear old dad. I will hide it. I will go to the police and confess the deed. If I'm still in jail in a week, I will tell the jailer there to find your confession.
Wrap me up a half a dozen of your excellent buns, Humphrey. And I will give you £200, plus the price of them.
Thereupon, Humphrey plucked a quill from his favorite goose in the back goose coop, sharpened it, and presented it to Charlie. With it, the lad wrote out his confession, paid up, and left. Humphrey waited for his wife, got permission to leave the shop, stopped at his house for a moment, then walked into the local constabulary, and made history with this statement.
If you boys are looking for a corpus, try 26 Bloom Street. If you're wondering what his name is, it's Charles Drew Sr. If you're wondering who did the murder on him, it's me. And my name is Humphrey.
The police, upon arriving at the appropriate room at 26 Bloom Street, understood immediately that foul play had been done. One of the constables was assigned to look in on the household of Mr. Humphrey, and there saw the Humphrey children at play at Thistle-de-Doo, a game usually played with marbles, but by the Humphrey children, played with pieces of iron junk, which latter were of a size that could easily be rammed down the muzzle of a gun. The gun was there, too, under a pillow on Mr. Humphrey's side of the bed. Mrs. Humphrey, who in the meanwhile had returned home, shook her head philosophically when apprised of the situation. It is recorded that Mrs. Humphrey's parents had both been put away as confirmed smugglers, a felony against the Crown. The next day, in jail...
Nice of you to visit me, Charlie.
Yes.
What news do you bring? When am I to be released?
I, I went to see Sir Roger Firebrace.
Well, how is Sir Roger?
Dead. It is a pity, too, for he would have gotten your release in an ounce for a few £100.
Don't forget, laddie, I've got your confession. You've got till Sunday.
The youngster, however, knew another man of note, Sir Chauncey Fenwick. Sir Chauncey was compassionate and understood the situation exactly, but unfortunately had just had one of his periodic fallings out with the magistrate's wife. But Sir Chauncey did not send the lad away empty-handed. He suggested an old sea dog named Captain Rat, with two T's.
Oh, what's the file, Mr. Drew? You'll be missing me. You couldn't be scraping my wrist.
I'm very sorry, Captain Rat.
Nervous, ain't you?
But I travelled here to London to talk to you.
You see, Sir Fenwick sent you to me.
Sir Fenwick took £500 and said he could do nothing with it. You're my last resort, Captain Rat.
A wee bit, dear, Mr. Drew. Aye. No. What can old Captain Rat do for you?
Do you have any influential friends?
What be you needing?
An alibi.
For yourself?
For a friend.
Aye. 'Tis always for a friend. What about him?
He confesses he killed my father.
And he be your friend?
By killing my father, he made me rich. I bear him no malice.
And for him you want an alibi. Why? Why not let him rot? Why, sonny?
You see...
You kill your daddy, sonny.
Keep the hook, Captain. You almost stuck me.
Pardon, young gentleman. An alibi you wanted it. For a friend. To say what?
That my friend is making a mistake. That he is having hallucinations. That he did not kill my father because he was with you the night my father died.
And where, Mr. Drew... Will that leave you?
Well, since one has confessed to the crime, it is doubtful whether I would be charged with it.
A sly one. Bein't you a sly one, young gentleman? Bein't you?
Oh.
I'll travel down to the jail with you and have a talk with your friend. How's that, huh?
Very good.
I'll need £500 for expenses.
Oh, yes.
Now?
Yes.
That is wasting a Saturday night and all, coming down here to the dungeon speaking to you, Mr. Humphrey. But I don't mind.
And you're going to furnish me an alibi, Captain?
This be a strange one.
I explained it all to you, Captain.
You kill your dad. This one here says he done it. Now the both of you want me to say he couldn't have done it because he was with me.
That lad thought it up. He's the bright one, not me.
My plan will work. By the time you get Humphrey out of here and the police begin to dig about again, I'll be in Paris, lost. I will change my name, and with my fortune I can...
For your fortune, I will do it.
I gave you £500.
Bah, the pittance. Your fortune, Mr. Drew.
Except what he's promised to me.
What about it, lad?
No.
Bah. Hey, lad! Pleasant talking to both of you.
It's Saturday night, Charlie. What will you do? It's Saturday night, Charlie. I've got your confession hidden away. And tomorrow's Sunday. What will you do?
And they looked at each other there in the dungeon. The jailed and the young visitor. And the question hung there. What would Charlie do?
It's Saturday night, and tomorrow is Sunday. What will you do, Charlie?
Listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Hyland. Tomorrow night, hear the premiere performance of 21st Precinct, a new hard-hitting mystery series revealing the inner workings of the world's largest police force. Precinct, produced by CBS Radio team that gave you Gangbusters. It's a program you'll want to listen for every Tuesday night on most of these same stations. Premiere performance tomorrow night on CBS Radio. And now, once again, Thomas Hyland and the second act of Crime Classics. And his report to you on the shrapneled body of Charles Drew, Sr.
It's a short, dusty road from Long Melford to London. Not only that, but these days it's hard to find. In its day, however, it was remarkable for two things. The brothers Shoe Spooner, Dick and Harry, who embarked on a career of highwaymanship on the morn of June 3, 1735, were hung on the eve of that same day from the highest branch of an elm at a fork on Long Melford Road. The other historic feature of Long Melford Road is the fact that on a Sunday morning, a young murderer, Charles Drew Jr., and his lady love rode a coach down its ruts.
Oh, he's a ranting, roving lad. He is a brisk and a bonny lad. Betide what may, I will be wed and follow the boy with the white cockade.
Liz.
What is it, dearie?
Shut up.
Everyone's singing that song, dearie. It's the rage.
Please, shut up.
Oh, duck, what's the matter?
You're the cause of it all.
What all, Duck?
My killing my father.
You wanted a way to have all his money? I told you a way to do, that's all.
Yes.
Oh, Duck, dearie. You'll see when we get to London what a time I'll show you. Make you forget.
Since I've killed him, I've done everything wrong.
Will you listen to Liz again? Will you?
Surely I'll listen, Poodle.
Oh, Duck.
Monkey.
Will you listen to Liz?
Surely.
When we get to London, we change your name, and you forget about Humphrey.
But if I don't get him out of jail tonight, he'll show the police my confession.
But you'll be in London. Start forgetting about him right now.
All right.
And so they fled to London town, little knowing that they had made a road famous. In London, they located a little-known hideaway called Bonhomme Carter's Thorny Bull Inn, on the corner of Asquith and Chiswick. The lad registered under an alias, Thomas Roberts. Liz, however, registered in her own name, Elizabeth Bathall. As this was going on, back in Long Melford Jail, where Mr. Humphrey was, there transpired this.
In 1 hour, Varthy, I'm getting out of here.
You be a fool.
How a fool?
Where'd you ever have so much money?
What bun are you baking, Varthy?
This bun. The lad's given you money, all that money, and he's good for more.
Aye.
All we want.
He's a rich one, that's true.
We can get more money before you show his confession.
How? You said he fled.
His Liz told me they were off to London town. You could write him a letter and say as long as he paid you £20 a day, you'd be willing to stay where you are.
£20 a day? That's a robbery.
I will go to London and find Master Drew and present him with the letter.
How will you find him?
I'll ask you in a bath of him.
London, eh, Barton?
London.
What of the children?
Mrs. Nickelrod says she will take care of them.
And you, alone in London?
So Mrs. Humphrey went to London. A few observations about Mrs. Humphrey. Wash away the flour and the excess dough. Put on long sleeves to hide the muscles made prominent from kneading bun dough. Comb the hair, exchange shoes for boots, and Gertrude Humphrey was rather presentable. When she went to London, Mrs. Humphrey did all of these things, plus making a mental note not to laugh too much, not only because of the horrible sound she made, but also because of the mischievous twitch it brought on, which she could not control. So, off she went to this place, to that, to this pub, to that, asking for a Mr. Drew. I should like to comment here that in 1739 the gin was of an excellent Holland distillation. However, its chemistry had a peculiar reaction with Gertrude Humphrey. Though she fought it, and though she laughed not at the most hilarious joke, including the historically famous one about Lady Mumbly and the Troubadour, the gin caused her to twitch mischievously. This attracted to her London dandies, who plied her with more Holland gin, and who promised her help in finding Mr. Drew, and who never did. But Gertrude never lost sight of her mission, and one night in a pub in Covent Garden...
Mister!
What's your present, dearie? Well, now, dearie?
I want a gin.
Gin for the lady. What's your name, dearie?
Gertie.
Aye. Here's your gin, Gertie. Drink up. Well now, dearie?
Is your name Drew?
Is that what you want my name to be?
I'm looking for Mr. Drew. Mr. Drew, is there a Mr. Drew?
Yes.
Oh, now, Gertie, I'm the one who's bought you the gin.
Yes, my name is Drew.
You ain't the Drew I'm looking for.
Well, now, why do you say that?
Here now, lad. I'm the fella who's bought her the gin.
Here's a guinea, my lad. Find another lady who likes gin.
Oh, I will, that governor. Thank you. Bye, Gertie.
Oh, now, why do you weep, pretty one?
You're so beautiful. Always crying, beautiful thing.
Gin for the lady. Now, stop that weeping. Here's your gin. I say, mischievous wink you have.
Is that truly your name?
Truly, Lady Bird, it is.
Lady Bird.
And you were looking for me?
Lady Bird.
My name is Drew, and you shouted for Mr. Drew.
So beautiful you are.
What do you want of me?
I've a letter for a man named Drew.
Really?
Oh, I want you, David. I really do.
Then give it to me.
You must turn your back now.
Right you are.
Yeah. You are a conniver, you are.
His name really was Drew, Timothy Drew. It's one of those coincidences in history which gave rise to the old saw, truth is stranger than fiction, as they say. And he was a curious man, and a proud man, jealous of his name, Drew. He had heard his name mentioned, and he was forced to find out why. He read the letter then and there. He read it again, a little later, out loud, to the police.
And my missus told you have gone to London with Liz Bathall. But, Charlie, my lad, you shall pay me £20 a day, else I will tell that you have murdered your poor daddy. I have your paper, which you confessed you did, right where nobody but me knows where. So when my wife hands you this letter, you better give her money and find a way to keep it, giving it to her, your faithful servant, Mr. Walter Humphrey. Gentlemen, here in London is a man named Charles Drew. He has murdered his father, and he bears the same surname as I. I cannot permit this deed to go unpunished.
Even in 1739, the London police were thorough, and, goaded by the enormity of the crime and spurred and accompanied by a man whose name had been besmirched, they combed the alleys, hostelries, pubs, dens. It was late on a moist Thursday morning when Timothy Drew happened into Bonhomme Carter's Thorny Bull Inn on the corner of Asquith and Chiswick. Bonhomme Carter denied the presence of a Mr. Charles Drew, but affirmed that a Liz Bathall was most certainly a guest there. He directed Timothy to Liz's chambers.
Who is it?
Open the door.
No games, dear. It's too early. Who is it?
A representative of the police.
Why didn't you say?
May I come in?
If you be the police, you can do anything, ain't that so?
Thank you.
I ain't done nothing.
Is your name Elizabeth Bathall?
It is.
Do you know a man named Charles Drew?
What's he look like?
I don't know.
Then how can I tell if I know him? Here, here, what sort do you take me for? There's no one in me closet.
What is this young man doing under your bed, madam?
A man? What's he...
Quiet, woman. Is your name Charles Drew? I'm talking to you under the bed there. Is your name Charles
yes,
Drew?
Sir.
Come out from under there, sir.
That's right, sir. My name is Charles Drew, sir.
And did you kill your father?
It would be a small life living as I have been. Yes. Yes, I killed my father.
I have the original issue of a Gazette dated January 22, 1740, from which I'd like to read. The melancholy proof that when a man has abandoned all religious principles and has suffered his depraved appetites and passions to govern his reason was shown yesterday when Charles Drew, Jr. was hanged in Long Melford. Since the hanging elm on Long Melford Road had recently been demolished to make a keel for the British Navy, a new gibbet was erected. This gibbet was equipped with a new mechanical device invented by Mr. Douglas Langford of Eastbourne. Mr. Langford is to be congratulated.
In just a moment, Thomas Highland will tell you about next week's crime classic. The shrapneled body of Charles Drew Sr., tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was adapted from themes of the period and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. Charles Drew Jr. was played by Terry Kilburn and Liz by Betty Harford. Featured in the cast were Paul Frees, Ben Wright, Irene Tedrow, William Johnstone, and Anthony Ellis. Bob Lamond speaking. And here again is Thomas Highland.
Next week, the office directly below that occupied by Oliver Wendell Holmes is the scene of a catastrophe. The place, Harvard Medical School. The time, 1849. My report on the terrible deed of Dr. Webster. Thank you. Good night.
It's big news when a former publisher, soldier, and congressman, the famous son of a famous father, stars in a new radio series. And this Wednesday night, you'll want to listen with all your might when CBS Radio stars Will Rogers Jr. as Rogers of the Gazette over most of these same stations. Rogers of the Gazette tells the story of a small-town newspaper editor, what he stands for, and also what he refuses to stand for. Premiere performance this Wednesday on CBS Radio. Stay tuned now for Gary Moore with Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts, which follows immediately over most of these same stations. And remember, America now listens to 110 million radio sets and listens most to the CBS Radio Network.
You're listening to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm Justine Ward, your host. Next, we have another true crime story. This one is set in India, along the banks of the Ganges, in British-controlled India in the late 19th century. A local British administrator uses techniques worthy of Sherlock Holmes to uncover the truth in this interesting tale. Enjoy Crime Classics, Episode 17, Rashi Among the Crocodiles and the Prank He Played. First broadcast November 4th, 1953, on CBS.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I am Thomas Hyland with another true story of crime. Listen. That's a couple of crocodiles roaring. They can do other things. They can snap, they can slither. As a matter of fact, when there's ooze around, they do this most often. They lay eggs, too, but no one's ever heard it done. The crocodiles who've been doing things for us are East Indian crocodiles, from a province in the south through which the Ganges flows. Each village in the province has its private pit, dedicated to the happiness of their slimy and slithering friends. And sometimes a fellow would lose hold and fall into the pit. Or jump in. Or be pushed in. However they got there, the crocodiles took them in their stride. People were their favorite dish. So tonight, my report to you on Rashi among the crocodiles and the prank he played.
Crime Classics, a series of true crime stories from the records and newspapers of every land. From every time. Your host each week, Mr. Thomas Hyland, connoisseur of crime, student of violence, and teller of murders. Now once again, Mr. Thomas Hyland.
Where the Ganges edged the town of Mahadwat, it was not holy. As a matter of fact, there was little to note in the town of Mahadwat. True, there was the crocodile pit, but the crocs were smaller than in, for instance, the village of Gumbau, just 3 miles down the river. Mahadwat had its share of temples, but they were kind of run down. It had its quota of fakirs, 4 of them, but none of them outstanding, as, for instance, the gray fakir of Gumbau, to whom everybody brought ashes. But it had one edifice of which the villagers were rightly proud, the house of Matabar, a rich and ornate house, of which Udi was its master.
It is written, when the moon is Ganges plucked, Vishnu looks with favor on a son who does not stray.
A gentleman, an old man, a widower with a son named Rashi.
Old man, listen to me. The world is not this village. The world is vast, and I must know it.
I plead with you.
The world, what I have seen of it. Fruits and ecstasies and all manner
Fool.
Of delights.
Fool. It is written, he who tastes sweets.
I care not what is written.
And what do you do when you wander, son?
Beg.
You suddenly become a holy man?
I merely don my rags, proffer a palm, and when enough coins are placed there, I doff the rags. Then, Then, Father dear, I dress splendidly again and walk to the bazaar. I have found, Father dear.
Mariah. Walter.
I have found, Father dear, that delights come most easily to a young man who dresses splendidly and who has coins. Surely that is written someplace. Or will be written. Father.
What?
I would not stray. I would remain in the village if you would give me of your wealth.
I cannot.
And why can you not?
Until Rashi, until son, you prove yourself a man. Then will I gladly...
Old man, give... old man, listen to me. I am more a man than you could dream of. I've been far already, 100 miles from here, and I will go further. And there will be a day when I will not come back.
Speak not so.
And I give you another barb to chew on, old man.
Speak not her name.
Kamala. Kamala, the cousin to my cousin. Perhaps. Perhaps, Father dear, I will marry her.
Speak not so. I beg of you, speak not so.
She is comely, Father, and of our blood even.
What if she walks slow by the river and tarries too long with the fakirs? What of the...
Get out! Get out of here! Go!
Very well. Shall I come back, Father dear? Ever? Shall I?
Son. Son to me. Let me awaken you in your bed here in the morning. Be of my house.
I will decide it. I will speak of it to Kamala. Then I will decide it.
We have gleaned two things about Rashi. He was a gadabout who visited strange cities and begged the price of admission, and he was a bad son. Here's something else about him. He played a musical instrument, a reed pipe. He would go out by the banks of the river, find a clearing in the jasmine, sit and look at the moon. He liked very much to look at the moon, for this same moon rode over the far places, and Rashi was a dreamer. Then, to his dreams, he would finger himself a tune. You might say, didn't he draw cobras? No. No, he didn't. He drew his cousin's cousin, Kamala, who had a weakness for reed pipers, especially her cousin's cousin, Rashi.
Blessed evening, Rashi. Of sadness is your song, and longing. Why longing, Rashi? I am here.
That is the moon, Kamala.
Yes.
A moon my father will not buy for me.
Wicked father. Rashi.
Yes.
Were he to buy it, what would you do with it?
Give it to you.
Wicked father.
Miser.
Old father.
Who will not die.
Rashi.
Who will never die.
Rashi.
What?
I brought you a lotus to tie into my hair.
Again?
You tire of me?
No. No, I never will. Give me the bud.
Yes.
Kamala.
Yes?
It would be well if my father would die. Oh, widen not your fawn's eyes in dismay, but think of it. It would be well if my father would die. Then the moon and what it looks upon would be yours and mine.
Look you there, where the river bends. Huzur the fakir glows his coals. Huzur the wise.
Not so wise.
Wiser than you, therefore wise.
You would go to him?
He has said to me, saying, Kamala child, in trouble and in question, come to me. Kamala child, saying he said.
My father is a trouble.
Huzur the fakir glows his coals. Let us go to him.
Yes.
Thank you.
yourself to the glowing coals, Kamala child.
I will be careful. Huzur.
It is grievous, this riddle you present. How say you it again?
The cousin to my cousin will tell it.
The riddle is this. In a far place dwelt a wealthy man. He prized his gold and his jewels above all, save his son. His son, to him, was as the gentle rain and the shining stars. Yet, impoverished, he kept his son. And the riddle is this, Fakir. Would not the earth spin more easily if such a father would die and be delivered of his wealth to his noble son?
I like riddles.
Well, would not the earth spin more easily, as Rashi has said, if such a father...
Rather, consider such a son. If such a son be dead, would not the father have an easier time? 20 rupees, please.
Do not pay him, Rashi. He has told you nothing.
Not 1 rupee, Fakir.
Very well. At least spread the coals for me so that I may walk and soon...
Spread them yourself.
Very well, child. Yet, I wish a blessed evening to both of you.
Blessed evening, Fakir. But no rupees. Come, Rashi.
What shall we do, Kamala?
We'll think of something.
How shall we start thinking?
With evil. Let us try that, beloved.
Enough food to eat.
Son, why do you mock me in the public market? And what you say is not so.
I am in rags, the son of a rich man in rags, nor is there enough to eat.
And villagers, listen, these lies you are saying. Why?
Listen all. My father sits among his riches and draws his hands over them and laughs in his beard. Nor does he give charity without expecting return.
Lies.
That is the truth. And I, his son, must share scraps with his dog.
I tell you this,
all of you, so if one day I am starved...
A curse on my son. Better he should be dead.
Which happened in the bazaar in the town of Mahadwat, so everybody heard it or was told about it. Results? Much nodding of heads and plucking at beards and mumbling and gossip at the wells. And more so when Rashi was suddenly not around any longer. Not at his usual haunts and no more piping of the reed among the jasmine. People forgot that Rashi disappeared from town quite often. Instead, they remembered what his father had shouted at him in the bazaar. A father had growled, and the villagers were mumbling. And one day, this happened.
What brings you to my house?
You are my cousin's uncle, Udi. Should I not be in your house?
Speak what you want and go.
I have a letter.
From my son?
No, not him.
Where is he?
I will read you the letter.
Give it to me.
Gently.
Very well, then.
To Kamala, beloved of Rashi. Very well, then.
Read it.
Do you pray me?
I pray you.
To Kamala, beloved of Rashi. The father of Rashi has slain him and has hidden his body.
Lie. What lie is this?
So the letter says.
Who sent such a letter?
I found it at my door. There is no name to it.
It is a lie.
Nevertheless, I will journey to Kumbawa, where there are people of England who are called police. And I will show them this letter.
Kamala, child.
I will journey now.
I pray you.
This minute.
did. She showed the letter to the police. They looked all around the village for Rashi. One of the more alert of them noticed that the crocodiles in the pit had been dozing for the last 2 days, which meant they had eaten a lot, which made the police drag the ooze. They found a bone. So they arrested Udi for the murder of his son, Rashi. The penalty for murder in the village was tearing a person in two.
Listening to Crime Classics and your host, Thomas Highland. This Friday night, hear the Death Bargain murder case, one of the most thrilling yet for Mr. Keene, tracer of lost persons. Under the terms of a strange agreement, two beautiful actresses find themselves in the shadow of violent death. It's a puzzler that calls for fast action and deduction by the old investigator, Mr. Keene of CBS Radio. Don't miss him Friday night on most of these same stations. And now once again, Thomas Highland and the second act of Crime Classics and his report to you on Rashi Among the Crocodiles and the prank he played.
A few words about South Konkan, India, in the summer of 1894. The weather was fine and the jute crop was phenomenal. Sir Ramsay Gwendon, better known as Sir Ramsay of the Loom, had just endeared himself to the populace by establishing the first twine and rope factory in the area, utilizing all but a small portion of the available jute. True, Sir Ramsay was later vilified as a slaveholder and his factories torn down by hand by enraged natives. Nevertheless, he is down in history as one of India's first prime users of jute. Now of the town, Mahadwat is, as we know, a rather insignificant part of the province. And in the summer, it is apt to run against the grain, especially the grains of Englishmen who are not much used to the brutal heat and swelter. So it came to pass that the Englishman who happened to be in town at the time, and who was a policeman, is an Englishman who should be admired. His name, Roger Sharman, a man of infinite patience.
Go on.
I did not kill my son. I did not.
Well, go on.
I loved my son. He was my strong right hand and my boon.
A moment. My dear.
Yes, sir?
What is it that you tell me has been bruited about in the bazaar? Child?
Ask anyone.
No, I ask you.
That this old man hated his son, cursed him, and threatened to kill him.
Sir?
Go on.
Do you know of this girl?
No. No, what about her?
She walks slow and smiles with ease.
Go on.
She is not to be trusted. She speaks lies.
Oh, good fellow. How do you explain this bone? Well?
Pardon, sir?
This bone. How do you explain it? The one we found in the crocodile pit.
Sir?
Yes, child?
The old man cannot explain the bone, for it is the bone of Rashi, of his shoulder.
I swear to you, I would not kill my son. I swear it.
Is it not true that you argued?
True.
And that you wished him dead?
In the
it
fit
is
of...
true.
Dear man, I'm afraid you're under arrest.
When will you tear him in two?
Child. Child, listen to me.
Yes?
No longer the law of the jungle, but the civilized law. Udi Matabar will be tried and justice will prevail.
Justice will prevail. This means death?
If he is guilty.
I am not guilty.
My dear fellow, you say that so often. What are you trying to hide, dear fellow?
History is full of coincidences, not the least of which the fact that the Sikh Pedwar was at this very moment in the village studying fossils. Amazing, you say. Nevertheless, a fact. Sikh Pedwar, but lately returned from postgraduate study at Cambridge, was hunting bone shards and artifacts at the old formations outside of the village. And it was to him Inspector Roger Sharman came.
I hope it won't be too much trouble, old boy.
From this?
Yes. I've heard it's done to reconstruct the figure of the man from the bone section.
Yes, yes it is. However...
Yes?
What are you trying to prove?
My dear fellow, should the figure you construct be 5.5 feet in height, of wide construction, and neck a bit longish, I'm told, then we shall have proof that a young man named Rashi has been chewed by the crocodiles.
I'll do my best.
Well said, old boy. Well said.
And 2 days later, Roger sent a runner to Pedwar, asking for a progress report.
Tell the sub I haven't yet begun to work on his project.
And a week later...
Some progress. Tell the sub to give me a fortnight.
And in a fortnight...
Tell the sub I'm sorry I was interrupted. My sister came of age and there was a celebration.
And a week after that...
Tell the sub he's welcome to come to see the reconstruction. Tell him I suggest he bring along the chap who's accused of the deed.
Which the runner did.
Good. Very good. Excellent. Thank you. Bully.
This way, gentlemen.
It is not my son. It will not be my son. But if it is my son, I did not do it. I swear it.
Will you keep saying that, old chap?
Right in here. There.
I say,
it is not my son. It is not
my... Of course it is not. It's a water buffalo.
Oh, I say. But then a joint of water buffalo was thrown to the crocodiles and not Rashi.
They would say so.
Then I am free.
Hold on, old boy. Only a part of your case against you has been destroyed. Your stand is still missing, and we don't know what you've done with him. You're charged, and you must stand trial. It's the law. Come along. Pedwar.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you very much. In the north, dear Kamala, towards Scotland, when the summer comes in gently, there are nights such as this.
And are you very rich, Inspector?
Oh, please, child, call me Roger.
Are you very rich, Roger?
Rich?
Yes.
How do you mean, child?
Money.
Child, you must listen to me.
To what?
The letter.
Letter?
That you received that said Udi murdered his father.
He did.
That said he threw his son into the pit with the crocodiles.
He did.
And the bone? It is the bone of a water buffalo, child.
How could you know?
But you knew.
How could you know? How wise you must be.
And Rashi is alive.
How very wise you must be.
Is he alive?
Come. I know a place nearby.
Kamala.
Come.
No.
Come.
Kamala.
Why?
Kamala, you cannot let an old man die. If Rashi is alive...
If Rashi is alive. If Rashi is alive. Find out if he is alive. Go.
Roger Sharman was a conscientious constable. Neither warm summer night, nor scent of lotus, nor closeness of Kamala, who wore a jewel and bells on her ankles, none of these distracting elements could keep him from his appointed tasks. His next move was obvious. Armed with a full description of the lad, he traveled downriver to the town of Gumbau, and there made inquiry.
Rashi, of the village Mahadwat. Therefore, a stranger to this village. Have you seen him?
And the answer was, no.
About this high, given to wearing beggar's clothes?
And the answer was, a shrug. So, journey to Maharashtra, and the inquiries. No, and the shrug. And to Pune, Pune of the fabulous temple of Shiva. and there was a beggar in front of it.
Of the village Mahadwat?
Exactly.
And of this height?
Precisely.
And young?
Yes.
And nose not too prominent, nor yet too small?
Yes.
And dressed in rags beyond belief?
Good, very good.
And his name?
Rashi.
Of the village Mahadwat?
Exactly.
And of this height?
Oh, yes, I understand, old boy. Only sporting.
A week ago, Rashi of Mahadwat went to Shadur to the festival of Vishnu.
The goddess Vishnu embraced thee with all her.
I say, old boy, isn't your name Rashi? Aren't you from Mahadwat? Aren't you?
No.
I say, don't try to run. You. Oh, very well. I say, now.
No.
Don't tussle. No, it's useless, you know. You're caught. You're a prisoner of the crown. Now, come along.
I therefore present to the crown this thesis, that Udi Matabar strangled his son until he was dead. Then in the still of the night he did...
I did not, I swear it.
He did dispose of the body of his son Rashi. I ask the court to look at the accused. Where in the court's memory has he seen such evil in a face, such depravity?
I am a good man. I have never harmed even a...
A face eaten by lust and avarice. His tongue tells the lie of serpents, and his eyes mirror the wantonness
no,
of...
No. This is my face, but I'm older.
So in summation, I ask that this symbol of wickedness incarnate be condemned to the gallows and...
Let us through, won't you?
What disturbance?
I'm sorry to spoil the show, old boy.
What is this?
Well, there'd be no murder, old boy. This bundle of rags is...
Rashi, my son.
It is I, father.
Ah, you see?
What a show. Rashi.
They would hang you.
No. I knew you would come back.
You knew?
Yes. Because you are my son.
Father.
Yes.
Once I was not your son. Now I am.
Did you hear?
Father.
Yes, son.
It is written, when the moon is Ganges plucked, Vishnu looks with favor on a son who does not stray.
Well said, old boy. Bully.
And arm in arm they went home, father and son. And the father was more generous with his wealth, and the son more generous with his love. And the girl Kamala? Why, Rashi married her, and they had a lot of trouble with their children. And the Ganges flowed down to the sea. In just a moment, Thomas Highland will tell you about next week's crime classic. Rashi Among the Crocodiles, tonight's crime classic, was adapted from the original court reports and newspaper accounts by Morton Fine and David Friedkin. The music was composed and conducted by Bernard Herrmann, and the program is produced and directed by Elliot Lewis. Thomas Highland is portrayed on radio by Lou Merrill. In tonight's story, Jack Edwards was heard as Rashi, Jane Webb as Kamala,
Edgar Barrier as Udi, and Ben Wright as Roger. Featured in the cast were William Conrad, Jack Crucian, and Eric Snowden. Bob Lamond speaking. And here again is Thomas Highland.
Next week, the Caribbees in the year 1704, when a girl could get a wedding present that meant something, like an island, even if it hurt her husband's career. My report to you will be on Blackbeard's 14th wife, why she was no good for him. Thank you. Good night.
CBS, CBS Radio will follow you wherever you may go. So if you want the very best, tune us in and be our guest on CBS, CBS, CBS Radio.
Lionel Barrymore's Radio Hall of Fame is great Sunday night drama on the CBS Radio Network.
Thank you for listening to the Old Time Radio Hour. I hope you enjoyed this week in our month of crime. Next week, we conclude our true crime spree with two more crime classics. I hope you will join us then for another set of interesting and entertaining stories of crime and punishment. I look forward to sharing them with you. I'm Justine Ward, your host, saying so long for now.